Please join me in welcoming our speaker tonight, Carla from Sherman Oaks, California.
Is this going to work? Can you guys hear me back there? Hello, everybody. My name's Carla Moore, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank Chris for inviting me out here to share with you guys tonight. It is one of my favorite things to do, to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't take this lightly. I'm pleased to be here, and I find it a privilege still today to be able to share what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today, and what I'm trying to be like today. Sometimes, you know, those get a little... And I want to thank Joe for being such a great host, and it was so nice to see old friends. I know Joe and Erica from down south, and to be here, I want to thank you all for your hospitality, for bringing me up here, and for dinner, and for your warm handshakes. This is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I can tell. It's nice to see a lot of different faces, too. You know, I speak a lot in the area where I live, and most of them can move their lips to my talk. So it'll be new to you. And I'll get right into it. You know, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I knew that I had a big problem. I knew I was in big trouble and that I was at the end and that I was out of answers. But I really didn't know for sure that Alcoholics Anonymous was going to be the answer. It seemed awfully simple. You know, I wasn't sure that it wasn't going to be some bad sort of motivational Tony Robbins kind of speaker thing, you know, where you feel real good and everybody's just jumping out of their seats, you know, for a couple hours and then it just wears off and everybody goes out and I don't know what happens after that. I should stop using his name because I'm sure that they're fine workshops. It's just that I wasn't sure this was going to work for me. And I'm happy to report that since September 25th, 1987, I have been sober. I have had nothing but Alcoholics Anonymous to keep me sober, and that's a miracle. All it's taken is everything that I have, and my full attention. And I want to tell you, too, if you're new, that if it's not comfortable, it wasn't comfortable for me either. I'm glad they didn't promise me it was going to be comfortable, but I can tell you all these years later that it's absolutely worth it. It has been worth every step I've taken in Alcoholics Anonymous to stay here and to be here where I stand tonight. I have a life that I never even would have known to ask for all those years ago. And if you're new and that sounds way off or maybe just a little too Cinderella, you know, stick around. And I used to hear early on that, come to AA, come to these meetings, even if your ass has fallen off, we'll teach you to sit a new way. You know, you were so warm to me, and you just, I didn't have to be anything more than I needed, than I was at the time. I didn't have to be, know any more than I knew. I didn't have to, nothing. I came as I was, and I got to stay. Now, when I got here, too, I would have told you, I don't know. The first thing an alcoholic gets back is their mouth, I think. But I would have told you I'm an alcoholic because of the crazy, dark, dramatic, violent, perverted family I had. If you had my family, you'd drink too. And I had just case after case after case I could make about that. And now I've been here long enough to know that, you know, that'll give you an inventory, but it doesn't make me alcoholic. Alcohol does something for me that it doesn't do for everybody. And I'm sure it must do that for you too, or you wouldn't be here trying to find out. I've since been around long enough to know that there are people who went through far worse than I ever did, far worse. And alcohol just doesn't do for them. You know, they don't take a drink and then go, and then need to have some more, and then drink way past the mark and end up in jail and institutions and in odd places, clothed, unclothed, scathed, unscathed. It just doesn't happen to them. And I've also been around here long enough to know people who lived charmed childhoods. Nothing ever happened to them. They were loved and had everything they wanted and needed as kids, and they are as alcoholic as I am. So who knows why I'm an alcoholic. It's just, I'm so glad I finally know. I don't want you to think it was all bad, though. I had a great time in elementary school. Fourth, fifth, and sixth grade was awesome. I found school to be kind of a refuge. You know, I'd just get there, And I was one of those kids, too, who was very enthusiastic. I am very focused when I get a hold of something I like, and I had to be the first around the track, and the first, you know, the best, get the most A's, and the in charge, and just, you know, by the time sixth grade was over, I was just tired, and I needed a drink. and then I started getting into puberty and all that, you know, all on into junior high, and I was getting clearer and clearer on the notion that you guys had the manual for living, and I certainly didn't. And boys my age started to take a different role in my life, and I got my first social resentment behind a game of spin the bottle. And I know that game's obsolete these days, but we played it back then. And I was at my friend's house, and we were passing around a bottle of his dad's whiskey, and we were spinning the bottle, and the bottle landed on me, and I went off into the bedroom with one of the boys, and we were both doing the same thing as far as I could tell, but when we came out of that bedroom, they called him a player and me a slut, and I did not think that was fair, you know. And I, still today, I will die on the hill if it's not fair, you know, just, I'll beat my head against the wall, can't figure out why I'm bleeding, and can't figure out why you won't move the wall, you know, I just got it, I just go in there, and now, those weren't my first drinks, but they were the ones that really started to kick in and let me know I had something to pursue and to focus on. I got a reputation in junior high, went through the school like wildfire. Girls my age were looking at me funny, boys my age were looking at me funny, and my feelings got hurt, and what happens to me when my feelings get hurt is my pride kicks in and I start to back away from my life. And I started spending more time in the girls' room than I did in the classroom, and started bringing stuff from my mother's medicine cabinet and from her liquor cabinet and sharing with the other girls in the girls' room who were backing away from their lives. And I hung out there as long as I could until school just wasn't doing it for me anymore. And I started to find my hope out on the open road. And you guys, I love the open road. I just got to go. You know, I identified with Merle Haggard when I was 6 years old, I swear. I want to be on the road again. All it takes for me is a long, slow train whistle and a Willie Nelson song, and I am gone. And I could be found on the on-ramps of the 10 freeway going east or the 101 freeway coming north, and I'd stick my little thumb out on that on-ramp, and I'd crawl in the car or the truck going wherever with whoever, and I'd be on my way to somewhere else. And I love that feeling. I love that feeling today. It's just that I like going home, too, you know. And I have a home to go to, which is a plus, you know. That's always nice, living indoors. So I started spending a little time in overnight in jail and juvenile hall, a weekend, a couple of weeks here and there, trying to go back home, live with mom, live with dad, and all that kind of stuff. And I never made any big plans about what I was going to do when I left home either. I was just on my way. I just knew it was going to be better. You know, the big book tells us that we all along we've been living on one kind of faith or another, you know, and I just knew it was going to be better somewhere else. And when I was 14, I found myself in a place called North Beach in the San Francisco area where a couple of guys propositioned my friend and I, and we said yes and did the next indicated thing, and boom, a whole new career path opened up for us, and down there on Broadway and Kearney. And I started living a day at a time in a way I've not had to live in a very, very long time. And you know, it wasn't so much, that wasn't the most harsh thing on my fifth step. It wasn't the worst thing, being a hooker. What I discovered on my fifth step was the way that I sold myself out in so many ways. You know, not just that. That was just the most obvious. But trade myself away so that you'll like me, or trade myself away for something I think I need in the moment. You know, inch by inch by inch, nickel by nickel. But it took a long time. You know, I did that for a very, very long time. When I was 15, the courts took over, and I found myself being admitted to a mental hospital. I was supposed to be there for 2 weeks, and I ended up being there for a year. I just sort of moved in and made myself at home. And they weren't talking to me a lot about alcoholism then. They were talking to me about disorders. So I was a very disordered-looking child. I was alternately violent and withdrawn, and living with a level of frustration down in my gut I haven't had to experience in a very, very long time. They were giving me daily nutritional supplements of Thorazine, Melaril, Valium, Dalmane sleepers. I guess they were concerned I wasn't going to sleep. And if you don't want to go crazy in the nut house, you got to get busy. And one of my favorite ways to be busy was the boys. I've already told you, I like all the boys, but my favorites were those sexy, smoldering types, you know. You know the kind. They're just sitting back there simmering. You just never really know when they're going to blow. Today I know that feeling as fear. Back then I found it very exciting. Trouble with boys like that is you're always having to say goodbye to them in the nut house. They're always doing something stupid to get hauled off to California Youth Authority, which was the next thing. And well, my first boyfriend got hauled off for throwing a chair through the window, and my next boyfriend was hauled off for throwing a nurse through the window, so that was progressive too. And you know, I'm always looking for the counterfeit. I'm always looking for that thing outside of me I think it's going to fix me. You know, it's just always, I'm always half a bubble off what it is I think I'm looking at. My perception just, you know, I mistake brute strength for strength of character. I mistake sex for love. I mistake arrogance for confidence. You know, I'm just always, looking for that power out there. And it took a long time. It took getting to Alcoholics Anonymous to learn that I get from the inside. That's when the gaping hole in my soul gets smaller. Not coming from out there. But, took a long time. I don't know about you, but I've always thought I should have a soundtrack to my life. You know, music playing in the background of all this sweet drama. And I remember one afternoon at the Nut House, I was sitting outside on the smoke break bench just outside the girls' unit, and I was watching my boyfriend Terry being cuffed and escorted off by security. He was the one who threw the chair through the window. And I remember smoking my tragic cigarettes, you know, just, the sweet agony of it all. And just inside the girls' unit, I could hear Diana Ross singing at top decibel, "Touch me in the morning, then just walk away." God, you know, it just hurts so good. And it took me a long time to realize that I was brokenhearted and blue before I ever had a real date. You know, it just all goes on between my ears. It's just in here. That's it. You don't have to wait for long, though. There's always another boyfriend coming through the nut house. Any minute, he'll be here. I went from the girls' unit to the co-ed unit to the intensive care unit. And I know today it was supposed to be the other way around, but I was not paying attention. I was not listening. Even with all the trouble that it caused, alcohol was still my best friend. Alcohol was still my higher power. It was still the thing that worked in the moment. I could still count on it. God. You know, and it wasn't like I didn't believe in God either. It's just that alcohol was so much quicker right now. You know, I was born into a Southern Baptist home, and that wasn't the problem. It's just that, all that praying and waiting around for God's will. What if I didn't like God's will? You know, I didn't have the patience. God, I found patience in a bottle of Cuervo Gold. I found patience in a bottle of Dewar's White Label. I found patience and hope and all that stuff inside those bottles. And so I didn't really have that. Alcohol still, today, is the only thing that drove me to my knees enough for me to bother spending any time at all, any focus, any desperation, any amount of time and desire establishing and maintaining a relationship with a power greater than myself. That's the thing that drove me to my knees. That's the thing that keeps me aiming in that direction. But back then, I was still drinking. I would find my way over the wall or under the gate sometimes. And I don't know whose bright idea this was, but we had parent group every so often, and they'd walk the patients through the front lobby to get to the parent group. And sometimes we put our street clothes on under our pajamas. And if you time it just right, and they're all looking that way, and the door's that way, boom, you know, you can sometimes make it out the front door, and sometimes I made it, sometimes I didn't, but it was always worth a shot. Go out for a couple of weeks, and then come back in. And I come back in the front door of the nut house, because why? Because the nut house is my home. And came back, and like I told you, I ended up on Ward D, affectionately known as the intensive care unit, and I met the love of my life there. He was kicking heroin in 17 days like we do, and in a snap recovery. And it's just been this last year it occurred to me, too. I don't know what it was on his mind, where I was sitting in the day room in my pajamas, I'm sure, but I had casts on my arms up to my shoulders. so that I couldn't cut them at the time. And and he walks into the day room and he's thinking, yeah, her. I want her. So I was 16, he was 22. I was coming off Thorazine, and I ended up going over the wall with him for the last time. And about 2.5 weeks later, my probation officer knew exactly where to find me. And it took me a little while to realize, I think he called her, and that hurt my feelings. Be careful what you ask for. So I got locked up again and into a rehab, and most of my adolescent life was spent in one rehab or another, and I never went out the front door of any of those places. The last place I was in was a girls' home in Pasadena, and I met my roommate, and again, we're seekers. I'm seeking. I want to hit the road again. I want to find that thing, the place, the special place, the where do I fit, the whole, that spiritual, I was reading lots of spiritual books and drinking a lot. And I've always been fascinated with the idea of the 60s, with the spirit of the 60s. You know, I just, well, that's why I went to San Francisco in the first place. But I was 12 in 1969, so the 60s were over by the time I got out in the world, really. And so all I had was this dream, this vision, and I knew that people stood up for things in the 60s. And there was the Grateful Dead and Traffic and all of those great, that great music, and they told us it's up in Oregon. You'll find that all up in Oregon. So we found ourselves on our way to Eugene, Oregon, and where God might be. And they rented a little house up there, down there, from here is down there, and they let me come along. And we planted a little garden in their front yard, and that's where I learned that hoeing, when they talk about that up here, that they meant with a garden tool, really. A little different idea. And I thought life was going to get different from the outside in. I really thought that changing lifestyle was going to do it. And two things happened that were significant that I could see looking back. And one was, if I wasn't going to do what I'd been doing for a living, I wasn't always going to be able to pay for booze. And I wasn't a very good thief. So without some sober solution, without a drink, without anything that I needed, I am restless, irritable, and discontent. And very hard to get along with after a while. I am not good sober, and that was at 17 years old. And the other thing that happened was, when I could drink the way I need to drink, I am always overshooting the mark. I don't know if I'm going to have 2 or 22, and most of the time it's the latter. And that was at 17 years old. I was already showing those signs, and yet I really wasn't ready to stop. It was still circumstances and everything else. It was all your fault. And if you had my family, if you had my life, if you had my boyfriend, if you had been where I'd been, then you'd drink too. And they had to ask me to leave. My friends had to ask me to leave eventually. I mean, if you're sleeping on your friends' couches and acting the way I was, then sooner or later, you know that day's coming. We just milk it for all it's worth. At least I did. And I ended up back down on my father's couch, in my father's house. And he had this beautiful shrine of a liquor cabinet. I have no idea why. He didn't drink a drop. Alcoholism runs through my family like the Colorado River, and it scared him to death. And to watch his daughter in the shape that I was in, I don't know why he kept it, but I figured it's got to be there for me. If he's not going to drink it, I might as well. And I sat on his couch in his den, and I drank, and drank every day. And I didn't know how to tell him I was afraid. I didn't even know that for myself, really. I didn't know how to tell him. I didn't know where the last few years of my life had gone. I sat on his couch and I drank until right before my 18th birthday, my father had to come to me and say what I know were the hardest words he ever had to say to his oldest daughter, and that's, I'm not going to watch you die, and I'm not going to help you do it. You got to go. And I knew that day was coming too, and all I could think about on my way out the door was that one of the counselors at the rehab had told me I was a great actress. And I know today I must have misunderstood, but I ended up on Hollywood Boulevard. And there's not a lot of auditioning going on out there, I can promise you that. I was 18 years old, starting my days off with a pint of pop-off vodka, and I would go wherever the day took me. And some days it was a party, and some days it was surviving. And there just wasn't a lot of hope about it getting any different. I just kept going. And sometimes when a young girl's getting into strange cars with stranger men doing strange things, things are going to happen. And you fall down, you get up, you take a drink, and you keep moving. And a few months into that, I met a man walking down Hollywood Boulevard, and I saw the light in his eyes, and I didn't know it was orange sunshine. We hit it off, and And I moved in with him that night. I didn't even know his last name. And 6 weeks later, he's asking me to leave, and I still don't know his last name. And I just like to bring him up because years later, he was on my eight-step list. He was somebody who clearly came to mind as someone I had run through his life spiritually, physically, mentally, materially, in every way somebody could in 6 short weeks when he had been nothing but kind to me. And I spent a few months trying to find him in my first year of sobriety, trying to make those amends, and I couldn't find him. I went everywhere I knew to go, and I still couldn't find him. And my sponsor said, finally, you know, you're going to have to set that down, Carla. You're just going to have to wait and try to find him later. But in the meantime, you can change your own behavior. You know, you can change the way you treat men. Try being a friend to a man in a vertical fashion. Why don't you start there? And so I left it alone for a long time until right before my 13th AA birthday. I had to go give a talk on the other side of town, and it was a hot Sunday afternoon, and I didn't feel like going. And thank God you guys have taught me it's not how I feel, it's what I do that matters. And so I got up and I went and gave that talk, and of course I felt better. Showing up is one of my favorite things to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I used to think when I was out there I could blow off a dinner for two and not think I'd be missed, you know, really. I just... You know, it was always going to be bad, so why go? And so I showed up, and I gave the talk, and it was over, and the thank you line came through, and this man stopped, and he said, hey, where were you in 1976? And it was a guy from Hollywood Boulevard standing in front of me with 8.5 years of sobriety, and I with almost 13. Not only a really, really smart, well-organized God, creative power, spirit of the universe could have planned that way. You know, I just... Still today, I have to use that example for myself when I think that God's timing isn't fast enough or good enough or quite quick enough or just right enough. I always know. And so I got to take him to dinner and make those direct amends to him. And I told him everything I knew to tell him and what I was willing to do to make it right. And he said, he had a couple things to say. Most of his sentences started with, are you sure you want to hear this? And then... We moved on, but he said, you know, Carla, that's long forgiven, long forgotten. I just can't believe you're still alive. And you know, he's right. If we're in this room tonight, we're the lucky ones. You know, we're lucky enough. Now, you know, hang on. If you're new tonight, this can be your date. You don't have to change it. It can be it. Like I said, it may not always be comfortable, but it's certainly worth it. I mean, we really have been through the worst of it. And it occurred to me later that if I had found him in my first year of sobriety when I thought I should, you know, he wasn't sober yet, so God saw fit to have that happen when he was 8.5 years sober. Anyway, that was a long time down the road, and I spent the rest of that year in Hollywood, and I hooked up with another guy from another rehab, and told you the rehabs are full of boyfriends. And again, you know, we're flying on the coattails of the 60s, and just loving the idea of peace and love and all that stuff. We just couldn't stop knocking the heck out of each other really long enough to implement the principles fully of peace and love. And so we beat each other up and down the California coast and pitched a tent in the mountains in southern Oregon and lived there till the rains came heavily and then moved into a roofless cabin just north of Grants Pass and threw a plastic tarp over the top, called it a skylight. And then the baby came. And I thought having this baby was going to change my focus. You know, if I just pay attention to her and do what's right, you know, maybe having to take care of her is going to change the way I see things, the way I drink. If I just drink this and do it this way and only, you know the story. When I'm trying to control my drinking, I'm not enjoying. When I'm enjoying, I'm certainly not controlling. And that went on until she got in the way of one of our fights when she was about 10 months old and I took her away and I took her up to Idaho where it's got to be better somewhere else. Idaho's got to be better. And I've got 3 jobs up there now. I'm tending bar and cocktail waitressing, and any normal person could have made a great living doing what I was doing, and I still couldn't bring home enough money to pay rent for more than a week at a time. So we're living in the rent-by-the-week motels up there, and my kid's one of those kids that you see by now in her T-shirt and underwear and yesterday's lunch going on the front of it because the mom's not paying attention. And I'm drinking scotch, just straight scotch, you know, no more bubbles, no more 7 or soda or any of that. That stuff gives you a hell of a hangover, really. So I'm drinking scotch, and I'm the common denominator up there. You know, they weren't bad jobs. They weren't shabby jobs to have. It's just that, you know, I start drinking. So Idaho's not working for us anymore either. We're back down in L.A. I'm renting a room for my aunt in Covina, and I've got a job in Hollywood tending bar. And again, it never occurred to me not to drink on the job. Why else would you have that job? So my daughter's almost 4 years old by then, and every afternoon I kiss her goodbye, and I take off for the bar in Hollywood, which is about 45 minutes away, and I stop at the halfway point because, you know, I need a break. And there's a little bar in Arcadia called the First Cabin, and I stop in there, and I'd have my primer drinks, my shots of Cuervo Gold and Budweiser Backs, and I'd get ready to get up and go out to Hollywood and pour drinks and drink with everybody till the wee hours of the morning and crawl back home and start all over again. And one afternoon, I kissed my girl goodbye, and as I had done months on end before, and I took off and I sat on that same bar stool in Arcadia, and you know, I didn't hate that job in Hollywood, and I didn't love my daughter any less on that day than I love her today. But I sat on the bar stool and I couldn't stop. I couldn't suspend my drinking that afternoon long enough to go take care of business in either direction. You know, and the only difference between that day and the day before was 24 hours. That's all. That's all that I can think of. And I couldn't suspend my drinking long enough to get up and go take care of business. And so I sat on the bar stool. I lost them both in one fell swoop. The kid and the job were gone. And then I started to live off the kindness of strangers there in that little area in Arcadia for about a month there, you know. And I'd start at the Drinkers Hall of Fame way down the street, 7 a.m., and then I'd end up gravitate down the street. And right about midnight, when the alcohol is just not working quite like it should, and I hear the band playing, and then I'm thinking about the kid. And I know beyond a shadow of a doubt now, you know, my gut's wrenching and my throat's closing, and you could walk her up to me and say, "You can have her back, Carla, if you'll just stop drinking." I knew that wasn't going to happen. I knew it wasn't. Alcohol had become my master. Now, I couldn't have articulated that to you then, but I know it now. I knew somehow intuitively that she was better off where she was. And so I drink all the harder, and eventually ended up in a little job just over in Pasadena. And now the bars I'm working in are becoming increasingly rustic, as are the people, as am I. And I thought getting married might be the answer. Maybe if I made my life look like yours, like I thought yours was, maybe if I get off the street and out of the business and change everything, maybe that's going to help. Maybe that's going to do it. And he and I got married about the time we should have split up. And we found a cute little wedding chapel just out off of Highway 15 down in California, just the other side of Shed World. It was a romantic... Shed World's still there. And we moved into that apartment, and the only thing that had changed for me was my location. 7 a.m., I'm cracking open those tall Budweisers, and I threw the first punch in that relationship, and we bought ourselves a big gun to protect ourselves from the night stalker, and the only people we turned that gun on was each other, and I just tried to get to it first, because I know the drill, and we became an active household. My first exposure to Alcoholics Anonymous was after one of our fights. We were at the bar where we drank, and we were fighting over whether or not I should get off the bar stool. Now, there's a reason, right, for the whole... And I lost that fight and ended up with some black eyes and broken ribs, and not a lot of people feeling sorry for me in that bar anymore, just glad I was leaving. And my husband picked me up and took me to the hospital that afternoon, and I can't tell you the amount of times. He must have been at cross purposes so many times, such a dilemma. I can kill her and have to save her life all at the same time. Because I'm always talking. I'm always talking and hoping you don't like it. So, you know, he's scanning the room trying to protect me. And at the same time, I'm talking to him, too. And so he's trying to kill me. And we're, you know, it's just not good. So he takes me to the hospital. And I get fixed up. And he brings me home. And he has to leave for work that weekend. So before he did, he set me up with a giant ice chest full of beer and a bottle of Beefeater gin. And now I'm drinking gin because tequila had been making me really mean. You understand. And I'm drinking and dialing, and I don't know all of who I called, but I know I felt like a battered woman, so I called a battered woman shelter, and I asked the woman who answered the phone to fix my life. And she asked me if I'd ever been to an AA meeting, and I don't know how she made that leap, but she did. And and what I heard her say was she'd fix my life if I went to an AA meeting. And, you know, that's the difference between what people say and what we hear all the time. You know, sometimes it's for the better, sometimes not so much, you know. But I remember maybe a couple months into my sobriety, I had some kind of weird sober obsession, you know. And it was probably a hymn of some sort. And I went to my friend and I said, "I just can't stop thinking. I'm so mad and I just can't get rid of it." And she probably told me something like, "Oh, pray for him," or some AA pearl, you know, that just took a second to say. And so I did it, and then I felt better, and I went back to her, and I told her, I said, you know, what you told me to do really worked. And she said, well, what was it I said? And I told her, and she said, well, that's not what I said. And I asked her what she did say, and she told me, and I said, well, that wouldn't help me at all. So so I'm glad I heard what I heard. So I don't know what all that means, except that I heard that woman that night. There was a woman speaker in the AA meeting, and I heard her say that somewhere during her drinking career she switched to beer, so I did. And for the next couple of years, I drank beer, and it gave me the illusion I was controlling my drinking. But still, first thing in the morning, I'm having beer until I'm passing out at night. And I had a distended liver. I weighed 110 pounds by then. I just felt like if you blew on me, I'd turn to dust. And that went on for another couple of years. You know, we got evicted from that apartment and ended up living in a little room in his ex-wife's backyard. None of us liked that very much. And I decided that if I could answer phones at home, maybe I could answer them for somebody else and get a paycheck. And I got a little alcoholic willpower together, got a job, and moved across town. You know, I got this job, though, and that's when a whole different kind of alcoholic torture started to happen for me, because up until then, if I had a job, I was drinking on the job, so and it was okay. It was sort of rowdy bars, and it just wasn't as prominent as it was trying to be in a straight place and do this. So I tried with all my might in the morning to leave home and not have those first morning drinks, the drinks that stopped the shaking enough for me to just get grounded and get into work. And so I find that when I'm not drinking, I'm thinking about drinking. And so I get to work, and I can't wait till lunchtime so I can finally have some drinks, you know, to have that thing, that magical elixir that stops the shaking. And so that whole time for another year, I'm either drinking or thinking about drinking. And it just, that walking torture. And finally, one Saturday afternoon, one more time, the cops are in the driveway, one more time, the neighbors are peeking out the window wondering what's going on at Charlie and Carla's house, and the kid's now 10 years old, and she's standing over in the corner in her mismatched clothes and her unkempt hair, and she got that look of fear in her eyes one more time. And now the cops leave, the husband leaves for the last time, they take the gun, everybody's gone, it's me and the kid in our little apartment. And, you know, I was in a better financial place than I'd been in many, many years. I had a little car, I had a little job, living indoors, not bad, had the kid back, and yet I was dying more than ever. And I knew that it was a matter of time, just a matter of time before it was all gone again. I knew everywhere I'd been, and I saw it all coming back at me. And yet I sat there on the couch and I drank, that was still my solution. My first sponsor told me if I wanted to effect a conscious contact with a power greater than myself, that I could start by counting the coincidences that happened in my life. And one of the first ones I could count was that I had moved in next door to a woman who had 5 years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she had seen and heard the whole fight go down. And a couple days later, she brought me a big book and a 12 and 12. And she came in and she knocked on my door, sat on my couch, and she told me her story. And in her story, I could tell that she used to drink like me. And over the last year, I had seen with my own eyes that she wasn't drinking anymore. And what impressed me more about that was it didn't seem to bother her that she wasn't drinking. You know, that got me. Because, see, untreated, without a fellowship or steps or a God or a bottle, I feel like you've stripped the coating off my wires. You know, I feel oversensitive and underloved, and I don't know what you meant by that or why you looked at me that way. And it doesn't get better from there. And sooner or later, I got to have a drink or go crazy. And she's telling me her story, and I'm thinking way back to the days before I had those drinks, right? Or before that drinking run, and I'm in the hospital, I'm in the mental hospital, and without booze, they're giving me all this stuff. They're giving me Thorazine, Melaril, Valium. Those are not easy, weak drugs. So I'm thinking maybe your little 12 steps aren't quite big enough to help somebody as crazy and extra anxious and specially unique as me. And I'm happy to report all these years later they've been every bit as big as they've needed to be. My neighbor left that afternoon, and as she was walking out the door, she turned to me and asked me if I had trouble accepting life on life's terms. And I said, absolutely not. Life sucks, and I fully understand that. And I'm not proud to say it, but I'm going to say it because I know that there are women in here who feel the same, who've been through the same thing, men too. And that's that, you know, I always believed that life was hard, and my child ought to learn that from me. Life is hard, and you might as well learn it from me. And I'm happy to say that's not our relationship today, but that's how it was back then. And I was hard on her and angry. And about a week and a half later, one Sunday afternoon, I just didn't go back and buy any more beer. And exactly what I thought was going to happen happened. The DTs set in, and I start to shake. And into Sunday night, I start to shake and hear and see things that aren't there. And into Monday, I'm shaking some more. And into Tuesday, I'm shaking again. And about Tuesday afternoon, I went back to my neighbor, and I asked her what to do. And she sent me up to a meeting in Sierra Madre down there and said, just go up there, and not that there will be any big question, but you should tell them that you're new. And so I went up there, and it was a 12 and 12 study, and I sat way back by the exit sign just in case. I heard a lot of people talking about nice things up there, small talk, you know, some stuff not even about recovery, just, you know, mowing their lawns and their kids going to school and stuff that I had no real idea about how to do, you know. And at the end of that meeting that night, the secretary did something very nice for me. She walked back with the format, and she asked me to read that portion of A Vision for You that we read at the end of a lot of meetings down there in Southern California. And this time I said yes. I just took it from her, and I said yes, and I started to read. And I came into the room just a little bit. And I'm so glad I did this time, you know. I just, and if you ask me all these years later, yes is still the answer. Yes, I'll set up chairs. Yes, I'll pour coffee. Yes, I'll pick up that newcomer. Yes, I'll tear down the chairs. Yes, yes, yes. It keeps me in the posture of hearing and delivering the message. I never know when my spirit, my feet, my heart, and my head can't catch up with where it is I'm supposed to be. And I come in here and I do my little job, whatever little job it is I have in this room. And you know, it sets me right. I never know what one-liner I'm going to hear from somebody that's just going to set me right just in that moment again. And I never know who's walking behind me who's going to need to hear or see that, God, if Carla can do it, maybe I can too. So I'm always, I always want to be close. I always want to be in the middle. And besides that, self-centeredness. You know, I did not understand what self-centeredness meant, really. Could not get my head around that concept just to talk about it. I had to be relieved from the noise on the inside of my own head first. And then I wanted to know how I did that. And how I did that was to take these little jobs to get my mind off of me for just a minute, you know. My favorite commitment in my meeting was the coffee commitment. That was my first and favorite. Somebody asked me to make coffee on a Tuesday night. I still hadn't finished drinking. They asked me when I wasn't sober. But they knew I was going to stay, I guess. And they asked me to come on Tuesday night and make coffee. And I came in. And you know, I love that commitment because I got out of work at 5 o'clock. At 5:05, I'm in the meeting. The meeting doesn't start till 8 o'clock, but I'm in the meeting at 5:05 because I'm in the grocery store and I'm buying stir sticks and I'm trying to remember whose birthdays it is and who needs a card and what's going on. You know, and pretty soon I'm not thinking about me, just for a little while. And you know, when I get that kind of result, I want to do that again, just like when I took my first drink. You know, I want to do whatever it was that gave me that. And over time, you know, you guys have given me a lot of those little bats, those little things that keep me going and keep my spirit right. I had to drink one more time in 89 days. I was tired, couldn't quite get across that bridge, thought a big book and a beer sounded just more like balance. And as soon as I took that first drink, I knew I wanted what I'd had just a few minutes ago, even with the discomfort, but I had to finish the drunk. And about 24 hours later, I sat and I had my last drink. My sponsor sat there at the kitchen table, and I threw out the bottles, and she picked me up and took me to the big book study that night. And that's where they gave me that commitment. And I'm just so glad, you know, I was in bad, bad, bad shape. Shape I'm not going to describe from the podium, but it was not pretty, and they didn't tell me to go away or sit in the back or anything. They just welcomed me in, and that's when they asked me if I wanted to make coffee the next Tuesday night. And I thought, well, somebody thinks I'm going to be here next Tuesday. And so all of those little things added up. They kept me in the rooms, and they kept me looking forward to something, and I was able to work. I kept that little job for some time after that, and I took these steps in my first year, and I had to. The obsession did not leave me alone. And I used to hate coming into the rooms and hearing people say, well, my obsession has been lifted. I'm 3 days sober. And
I'm going to the dance Saturday night. I'm going to learn how to dance in sobriety.
And I wanted to learn how to pay rent more than a month in a row. You know, I. So I had to take the steps. And oddly enough, the obsession began to lift when I started making those amends. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and surrendered, but still fighting, I guess. You know, tired and still fighting. A long it's a long way. The troubles arise out of myself. And I made that first round of amends to my family. I owed them the most. I had consistently broken their hearts day by day by day for years and years and years. And it was going to take more than just that one talk to get past this. It was going to take the talk and then some action, a lot of action. And especially my daughter. And women started asking me to sponsor them. And that's when the light really comes on. You know, I got a lot out of my fifth step. But man, every time I listen to somebody else's fifth step, I see me and I see her and I... That love and that compassion, I mean real love, love that comes from the truth. You know, it's hard. It's not always easy to face, but it's there and it's real and it's substantial. And so that began to kick in. After a couple of years, I had had you guys, but my daughter didn't have anybody really. She was 12 years old, starting to come home, beat up and bloody at all hours of the night. She'd been jumped into a gang, and I was busy being wonderful in Alcoholics Anonymous, 2 and 3 meetings a day and my job, and I'm thinking I'm doing pretty good, putting food on the table and holding down a job and paying rent more than a month in a row, and things are getting better, but she needs me, and I've always been kind of afraid of her. I mean, not like I couldn't take her, but because I didn't really know how to talk to her. I didn't know if I would have what she needed, and I felt really lacking there, so it was easy for me to hide in meetings. And, you know, it says on page 19 in our book, not page 164, that a more important demonstration of our principles happens in our respective homes, occupations, and affairs. And if I'm only doing it in these rooms, I'm only half doing it. And I had to stop going to 3 meetings a day. I'm not saying don't go to meetings. Don't walk out of here saying Carla said don't go to meetings. I did not say that. And I've had that happen. But I had to stop going to 3 a day and take it into my home. And I had to put her in a treatment center, and I was scared. I thought I was signing her life away, and I thought, oh, my God, here we go again. And as I was sitting at this table and not feeling very good about me or anything, and I felt a hand on my shoulder, and I looked up, and it was a guy from my home group who happened to be the recreational therapist there. And I knew she was going to be okay. I knew she was going to be exposed to some of the love in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I showed up. They asked me to show up on certain nights, and I showed up to have her tell me she hated me, and I showed up to have her tell me she loved me, and I had to go with it. You know, there was no, in making amends, there was no promise necessarily and no expectation of her coming back and loving me or liking me or any of that, but it was still mine to do. It was mine to do. I owed her that. And after 6 months, she got out, and things were perfect. I mean, things were better, but they weren't perfect. And you guys taught me here, I learned it in Alcoholics Anonymous, that mountains are moved a spoonful at a time. And what I got to worry about today is today's spoonful and do it the very best I can. And I was getting better jobs, so I was better able to take care of us at home. And she got out, and she wanted to go live with her dad, so I had to get out of the way and let her go do that. And I had to shut up about my favorite subject, which was how he'd ruined our lives. I just love that. And, you know, things got better when I shut up about it. And it was a good thing. Like I told you, my God has always gotten bigger. I came here the bewildered one, the 12 and 12 calls it. I had a lot of cockamamie ideas, a lot of, you know, homemade, inexperienced ideas about what I thought God was. And so a lady named Susan said, why don't you just call him God and let him get as big as he needs to be in your life? And why don't you start there? And so I love that, how the book talks about infinite power and love. When Bill said, I stood in the presence of infinite power and love. And I came here, I had the trouble God. You know, I had a lot of trouble. I needed a trouble God. And I got the parking space God for a while, you know. And I liked that God. You know, it taught me how to take no for an answer. You want to park here, get here early is what I learned. I learned that I have a responsibility. God will do for me what I can't do for myself, but what I can do, I fully believe I'm expected to do. And then somehow all these years later, now I feel more a part of what I believe in than separate from. And certainly if I could describe God, I'd be bigger than God, and I don't want that. So while my daughter was living with her father, I was going to work and going to AA, and I went to the gym one night, and I came home and took my shower as usual and went to bed and woke up in the middle of the night to a man standing over my bed with a knife to my neck and his hand over my mouth, and he said, "Don't say a word or I'll cut your head off." And he took the telephone cord and he tied my hands behind my back and he raped me and he robbed me that night in my bed. And I want to tell you, that night, I had a big God. I had a real big God. You know, I didn't have that immature God that exists when things go my way and doesn't exist when things don't go my way. I had a real God, and I knew that things were going to go the way they were supposed to, whether I like them or not. The second step asked me to choose to believe that God's everything or he's nothing. He is or he isn't. And I got nothing to lose by believing he's everything. And so it was a matter of time. I mean, I was focused and I paid attention. And there's a man on my back in the middle of my bed in the middle of the night. And when the time was right, I tried to get away. And I couldn't get out the front door. But we got into a fight. And he ended up going out the same window he had come in. And it turned out that I had known him. I'd watched him get sober 30 days before I did. And I watched him get his life, his wife, his kids, and everything back. And then I watched him join the church, leave AA behind. And when he went out like that. And the first thing I learned from that I carry with me is that while the big book tells us to be quick to see where religious people are right, this is the place where I learned the terms and conditions of my disease. This is a place where I learned that I'm not one of those people who can go home after a Sunday sermon and have a glass of wine. Once I remember that, I can go anywhere I want to and practice that 11th step, or nowhere. I mean, this has been big enough for me. I pay attention and I read a lot, and I listen to a lot of different spiritual teachers, but I have to come here first. I can't forget who and what I am. There was a trial that followed. They caught him a couple weeks later. And I had had a man sponsor up until then. I had a great guy. He was just a big guy who looked like Jerry Garcia. And he was very very bare bones, you know, very plain. And he'd say things like, "Well, that's going to feel a whole lot better as soon as it quits hurting." But then it was clear. I mean, I'll tell you, talk about principles before personalities. You know, the people that came in, the AA swooped in around me. You know, the next day, the day after this happened, first of all, the lady who carried the message was now living across the alley from me, and she came over that night. We went to the hospital, talked to the police, and did all that stuff. And never once, you know, for what you guys had given me in the first 5 years, never once did it occur to me not to call the police. Never once did it occur to me that, well, maybe I had asked for that or put myself in that position. Never once did any of that stuff occur to me in that time. Now, later on, I had some overshadowing ideas, but in that, it was okay for me to ask for help. And then the following day, I was talking to this lady who was always in my life. We couldn't really stand each other, but we were in each other's AA lives all the time. And I had run into her after I had done an H&I panel at a hospital. I ran into her in the parking lot where she had just come visiting her mother, who was dying of breast cancer, and talked to her for a little while. Went up there to sit with her and her mother, and stuff like that would happen all along. You know, where you just say yes, you just go. They ask you to go, and you go. And so the next day, I'm talking to her on the phone about stuff. We were part of the same home group, and I told her what had happened, and she said, "Let me send Kenny over to pick you up." And I want to tell you something. 5 years before that, nobody was sending their husbands over to pick me up at all, and let alone bringing me home to stay with him for a couple of days. But she had no hesitation about that. She sent him over to pick me up, and I spent a couple of days with them in a soothing environment where I could sit and think and put things back together. And then I went to the meeting. My sponsor, Lee, picked me up and took me to the meeting and my Thursday night home group. And I was sharing in a general way. It was time for me to tell my group what had happened in a general way. And I couldn't feel it yet. It was just strange to me. I couldn't feel it yet. I was just talking about it. And when I couldn't cry for myself, the lady sitting next to me, my friend Penny, started to cry as I was sharing. And, you know, you guys just held on, held me up. You held me up and walked me through. And that's when I learned about compassion from the other side, that we do things for each other. There was a trial that followed. And now, I had had Lee, and he had helped me and everything, but it was time, obviously, for both of us, for me to get a woman. And that's when I got Marguerite. Now, every sponsor I've ever had has walked me to the next one. They've helped me through whatever it is, and we never know what that is going to be quite, but sponsorship is not ownership, although it's close, if you know what I mean. I pay attention to them, although I'm not one of those people who's had the same sponsor for 20 years. I'm just not, but anyway, you get the idea. So Marguerite says, you know, you're going to have to forgive this guy. And I know she's right. I know that we're people who can't handle even seemingly justifiable resentments. I know she's right. At 5 years of sobriety, it's clear as a bell to me. But, man, the guy had scared me. You know, I stand on the street and I hear a car door slam and I jump and I get pissed. Because I don't like anybody owning me that way. And I'm embarrassed and I'm mad. My pride's hit. And how did I let that happen? And then I'm going. Then I'm going. Then I start with the maybe a girl like me is just bound to have something like that start to happen. La, 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 la. And my home group swept in. And they'd say things like, Carla, maybe you just got in the way of somebody not looking to do God's will. Maybe it had nothing to do with you at all, except that you're going to be responsible and go testify. And I had to testify in one hand and I had to be responsible and forgive in the other. And those happened simultaneously. They were not at cross purposes doing that. But I didn't. It didn't happen easily. I mean, the seven-step prayer became my mantra. Every morning I woke up with a desperation saying, and I hated the way I felt. I hated the way that owned me. I hated being that afraid and having people know it. Anger is my favorite. Anger just makes me feel focused. And like I've got a purpose. And like you can't hurt me. And at 5 years of sobriety, it's like a suit that doesn't fit anymore. I can't be angry. I can't not be angry. And I don't know what I'm supposed to look like on the other side. And that's when, thank God, that second step again kicks in, because I don't have to know. I don't have to be more than I am, no more than I know. I just come to Him and ask. And then that seven-step prayer, like I said, became my mantra. And I found that sense of forgiveness, the beginning of it anyway, in the courtroom. There was a trial that followed, and as part of the defense, he had had a lot of the guys I had known in the bars years before come up and testify as to who I used to be. And a lot of the things they said were true, and some weren't. And so I had to get somebody to come and testify on my behalf as to who I was at 5 years of sobriety. And by then, I was working at a big investment firm in downtown Los Angeles. I had been a secretary, and the division head of the firm where I worked just stepped up, and he went down there and they told him all about who I used to be. And he said, yeah, but she shows up early and she stays late, and she was where she said she was. And see, that's Alcoholics Anonymous speaking for itself. He didn't have to be coached. He just got up and told the truth as he had experienced it through me. And then it was my turn to get up and testify, and I sat up in the witness stand and I looked out and I saw him sitting at the defense table. And it occurred to me that what stood between he and I at the time was a drink. That if I were to go out, I could be sitting in a spot. And I began to see things from a little bit different point of view. Now, I know we don't have to debate all that goes on into that kind of crime, but from my perspective, what stood between he and I was a drink. And what happened for me was we became two alcoholics sitting on opposite sides of the courtroom. And that evened it out just a little bit. And just a little crack of light came in under the doorway. And I was able to start to let that fear dissipate. And it did. Eventually, about 18 months later, the nightmares and all the things attendant to something like that happening disappeared. So it wasn't overnight. It wasn't, I know that things like that happen overnight, but it wasn't for me. And the detective who worked the case came to me after it was over, and he said, I don't know who you were back then. I'm not even sure I want to know, but whatever it is you're doing now, keep doing it, because it seems to be working. See, that's Alcoholics Anonymous speaking for itself. He got 20 years, and he did 13. And Alcoholics Anonymous, my home group, swooped in around me when that guy went in, and when he was coming out, and I got that letter, Alcoholics Anonymous, whole different home group, whole different side of town, swooped in around me one more time. That's the fellowship, you know. And I've always found that the fellowship will drive me into the steps, and the steps will drive me into the fellowship, and so it should be. I'd like to tell you that for the next 14 years, my life just shot straight up, and I just never had another trouble at all. But, you know, my ego goes from zero to zoom in a very short time. I get busy. I told you I'm an active girl. And I started back to school. I had these bright ideas. You know, the 6 and 7 step talks about, you know, right motives and, a good idea to start with, and then how it can get warped way beyond recognition. And I wanted to do something good, and I went back to school, and pretty soon those community courses were starting to kick in, and that job I'd been so grateful for, now I'm overworked and underpaid, and I need to become CEO of something very soon. And, and somewhere along the line, that line smudges again between God's will and my will, and I just take over, and I start to power drive my own life, and I just get in there, and then at all costs, get out of my way at all costs. And before I knew it, the long story short, you know, I met him, and I thought, oh, how efficient is my God, a boyfriend and a business partner all at the same time. And I loaned him a bunch of money for this business venture. Voluntarily, I did it. And at 10 years sober, I'm bankrupt, and he's gone. And and it's a good idea, too. If you're going to be in a relationship, I don't care if you've been here a day or 20 years, if you're going to be in a relationship, be in the same one they're in. And I think it gets easier to tell when you've had a few years of sobriety. I'm just going to say that. more than I had. In any case, so I'm whining again. If you had my boyfriend, you drink too, and I was getting real depressed. I had actually called a psychiatrist. I thought maybe 10 years is all I get. Maybe this is maybe this is it for me. And I made that appointment, and I never had to go. What I did instead was it was time to call and get some new help. And I had heard a lady named Rita share from across town, and she had shared about having some similar stuff happen and how she paid all that money back. And a little at a time. It was more money than I even knew I had. I mean, the good news was that I had the credit to get that kind of money. The bad news was it wasn't mine anymore. But that was only funny to me. So I got behind her, and I got behind my sponsor, my now sponsor, Pat Y and Vince Y, and they said, you know, we can help you. And we have a financial amends group that we do in our group down south. And we help each other get through financial amends like that. And I started to pay that money back, and my life started to change. Now, I haven't paid all of it back, but I've paid a good deal of it back. And my life started to change again. And I had to get busy in Alcoholics Anonymous one more time, over and over. You know, I've had to start over a lot of times in Alcoholics Anonymous. Just haven't had a drink to do it. You know, and that's okay. It's going to be messy. It's going to be what it is. But I've gotten to do it sober, awake, and alive, and looking you in the eye. I don't have to hide. I want to let you know that my daughter came back to live with me, and things got better. Not overnight, but just little by little by little again. And I got to be present at the birth of my first grandson. She and her boyfriend came in with that look on their face, and I got to tell them they were pregnant, you know, that kind of look. And I got to tell her I was going to be there for her no matter what. Whatever she decided, I'm there. And now I'm Grandma Carla. She's got 2 kids of her own and just married a guy with 3, so I'm Grandma Carla of 5. And they all like seeing me coming. You know, none of them have had to experience what their mother did. My daughter experienced a lot. I used to have to come in here and tell you guys I put my hands on my daughter one more time. And I did not like that. And I had to quit doing it. And when I can't control somebody, I hit them. I think I used to think. I don't think that anymore. I don't have to do it. But if there's any of you out there that's struggling with any of this stuff, you know, none of this stuff has to be a secret in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, there are all kinds of us in here, and we got this one common thing that brings us in here, and a common solution, and God, you know, it just works. My dad doesn't have to sit up nights anymore watching the news to make sure his daughter's name isn't on the list of the victims of the serial killers of the day. You know, he sleeps well. My mother was the hardest. I know I'm running out of time now. I can't believe I'm running out of time already. I'll sit down, and I'll tell you the story. I'll sit down. About 2 years before I got sober, my baby sister committed suicide at the age of 17, and it took her all weekend to die. And while we were at the hospital, I'd leave the waiting room and I'd go out to the parking lot and I'd drink and I'd come back in and I'd just rake my mother across the coals and I'd talk to her in a way a daughter should never talk to her mother, especially when her baby lay dying in the next room. And I don't know how you make amends for that, really, except that I started by calling her once a week and trying to find out how I might give to her in her life and add to her life instead of taking all the time. And over time, that's worked. I mean, we've become very, very close. And I call her way more than once a week now. So much so that about 5 years ago, when my baby brother died of this disease, he was 6'10", 160 pounds. When he lay on life support in a Spokane hospital, he had little pinholes in his heart from doing crank, and he wasn't going to stop drinking. I got to go up and be the kind of a daughter my mother needed while she buried yet a second child. And I don't know what kind of pain that is for a parent, really, but I know that this time, because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I got to be part of the solution rather than part of the problem. And you know what I'm like today, what I'm trying to be like. Over time, I guess you can tell I'm kind of a type A personality. And, you know, I just start moving whether I have a direction or not. And it's gotten better over time. But I found myself in a ballroom dance studio about 3 years ago. And who knew? I certainly didn't. And I didn't realize how rigid and how stiff and how, you know, just I had gotten until I tried to take a rumba lesson, you know. You got to get a little wiggle on to dance a rumba, you know. And my teacher got about halfway into that lesson, and he threw up his hands and he said, "Oh, Carla, do not try to dance like a good girl. I don't think they will believe you anyway." Yeah. In the 9th chapter of our book, it says our dark past will become our greatest possession, and my past has been woven into a huge tapestry that is my life. It's there for those who need to see it, and yet I walk a free woman in the real world, awake and alive. My friend Don Newcomb said he was concerned about me when I started doing that dancing thing because he was afraid I'd get so in love with it it'd take me away from AA. But what he said was, "I can see now that what had to happen was a little girl who went to North Beach had to step aside so the lady who can dance could come out. And I hope if you're new that you'll stay long enough for that to happen to you. That's how I know I have a God. He answers questions I don't ask out loud and don't even know they need to ask. And stay till you find him." Thank you.